For most of us, Dr. John Patrick doesn't need an introduction. But if he's new to you, you should know he's retired from the University of Ottawa in June 2002, where he's taught at the medical school, professor in clinical nutrition and pediatrics. John did his medical training in London, then did extensive research in the treatment of childhood nutritional deficiencies and related diseases, held appointments in Britain, the West Indies, Canada, has done a lot of work in Central Africa, and working in programs on childhood protein, energy, malnutrition. He's paid his dues in medicine. But more importantly, and for us, is he's an expert in apologetics. He speaks frequently to Christian and secular groups and is able to communicate effectively on moral issues in medicine and culture and the integration of faith and science. I've asked John to join us at the microphone here at Christian Doctors Digest, kind of catch up on what's been going on in his life, but more importantly, what's going on in his mind, because he's going to have some thought-provoking things to share with us. John, great to have you back on CDD. It's been too long, and you're always running around the country. I have a time of getting you on tape.
You're a fine one to talk about running around the country. Yes.
That's true. Tell me what's been going on at Augustine College. Been hearing some exciting things.
Well, we've finished another year and about to start the next one. It's the first time we've had medical students in process come and take a year off to be with us. We nearly didn't take them at the beginning because we weren't sure they could write the number of essays we wanted from them. And at the end of the year, they were writing spectacularly good essays, and it was a pleasure to have them around. And
I think it's neat to kind of see college students, kids straight out of high school, medical students all doing this together.
Not this coming year, but the year after. I've got a 40-year-old lady from Australia coming.
Wow.
I was in Australia a couple of years ago, and I got an email earlier this year. She said, "When you were in Queensland, I heard you. I've got all the tapes of yours I could find afterwards and Father Spitzer's. I want to come and take your course. I was divorced, but that was some time ago, and I'm counselor to 1,500 high school students. And will you take me?"
Wow. That's great. That's great.
So we don't know where it's going, but clearly the course is appealing to people over a broader spectrum than we initially thought it would.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a guy who's into one of the best PhD programs in the country taking a year off before he starts it to come to us this time.
Wow.
So people in university who realize that university is dangerous to your faith and seeing the warning signs come up are taking a break and coming to us, and it's a very good way to use the college, a one-year intensive program. I think the thing that I'm most proud of about the college is that I don't know of any of our graduates who've lost their faith in school afterwards.
Hmm.
Now, there must be some. I don't know exactly where all of them are, but I know where most of them are.
Yeah.
So we have a very, very low dropout rate. There is one drawback for some people that we're producing too many philosophers, obviously.
And you're still doing your weeks for doctors in the summer where they can come up and get a kind of an intensive course.
Oh, yeah. Yes, and we finished the third one in June.
Well, what have you been thinking about lately? Tell us what's going on in your mind. Probe in there and see what we can learn today.
Yeah, well, my children tell me it's falling apart, but they're probably right, too. A couple of things have made me think a lot. One was an article in First Things from October last year by David Hart called Christ and Nothing, which made me rethink something I've been saying for a long while about where we're going. I think David Hart's more accurate than I was. The other thing that I think we really need to think about is what I call the changed etiology of disease over my medical lifetime that hasn't been recognized in any textbook and has huge implications for Christians practicing medicine. In fact, I think it's a huge opportunity for us. And that leads into something that's on your heart and mind as well, is how on earth do we have a medical system that is more justifiable in terms of justice and democracy?
Mm-hmm.
Because most people stubbornly refuse to believe the liberals and cease believing in God. God was supposed to disappear. Instead, religion is growing everywhere. Now, they hate that, but it's true. And the medical system shows no response to that reality.
Let's get into that a little bit. What exactly do you mean? What has changed in the etiology of disease?
Well, even in your lifetime, which is a little shorter than mine, if you think back to when you were doing family practice at the end of your training before you became a missionary, What proportion of the patients who came to you in your office came there because of what might be called an act of God or nature? And what proportion came because of their own behavior?
Probably 75% came because they got sick and 25% because of behavior.
Yeah. What about now?
It's changed tremendously. I mean, the vast majority of patients you see come with some sort of psychological overlay or they have caused their disease.
Yeah. And that is not discussed in any textbook as an explicit and important issue. And yet I think it's the explanation for the fact that patients are receiving technically better treatment than they've ever received, and they're less and less content with the system. And doctors are giving better and better treatment, and they are more and more demoralized. That doesn't make any sense at first sight. And I think the reason is this. It's in this little capsule. Because if you are sick and suffering because of something you have done to yourself, and those you say you love are also suffering with you, what can you not avoid knowing and feeling?
Guilt.
Guilt. Now, it's like pulling hen's teeth to get that out of most medical audiences. You just have to be very patient and say, I know it's a word doctors don't like to use, but is guilt real? Of course it is. It's very real. What's even worse is they can't even name it because it hasn't been brought to the surface. And even in our churches, we've ceased to talk about sin and guilt. We've psychologized it. It's always somebody else's fault, isn't it? The whole growth of pseudo-human rights is another feature of this phenomenon. And it's not true, and so it's going to be bad for society. It's going to produce a dysfunctional society. So, they come in with, let's say, an STD. They're treated excellently, and they go away complaining about the system. Because they actually came in with a small problem, technical problem of an infection, and a huge problem of a lifestyle that made an STD possible. Mm-hmm. About which they cannot avoid feeling guilty. Now, one of the books that can help with this, I hope you sell it at CMDA. If you don't, you should.
If you mention it, John, we probably will.
That's Jay Budziszewski's book, Things We Can't Not Know. Now, it's a title he means you to have a double take on. In other words, there are things that are hardwired into us. And a question that will open this up in any medical audience. I love asking it in very liberal settings at the beginning of a lecture. I'll say, stand up if you can defend the taking of an innocent human life apart from just war, self-defense, and judicial execution, for which there are significant literatures. Nobody moves. Now, I'm in a liberal environment. I say, now, how incoherent can you get? Because most of you are pro-choice. Now, you're honest enough to say that what you deal with in an abortion is alive. You know it has a human genome. And if you aren't innocent then, you never will be. How do you account for that? Now, that incoherence is always there, and it always hurts. It's like an infection that's locked in. Eventually, it's going to erupt somewhere. And that's what our society is dealing with. That's why the sanctity of life is so important. And even as physicians, we've still got a long way to go with dealing with these things. Because you can ask of most churches, do you show, for instance, the Nathanson video, The Eclipse of Reason, every year? Do you have an annual lecture on sexually transmitted disease and sexuality for your young people? And the answer is no. So we ourselves have not yet recognized that these areas of life are now fundamental to what we call health, and we aren't discussing them. We've allowed the agenda, as usual, to be set for us by the opposition, instead of standing back and saying, what is it that leads to human flourishing? And we have it set out for us in one verse. I have heard what these people have said, oh, that they would have such a heart and mind as this to keep my law, that it might go well with them and their children forever. And at a deep level, we don't actually believe it. We believe it at this level, if we asked cognitively. But it's not hardwired into us. It's not a facilitated pathway, is it?
It's not. And it's interesting, too. I just watch what's going on in the media as well, you know, in the entertainment media as well as the news media. And what you see again and again, I know we were talking as a family, how many movies and programs are about dysfunctional people?
Yes.
And that's what entertains people. You think, why would people want to watch this? The reason they want to watch it is because it normalizes
Yes.
How they're feeling, and justifies and say, well, I'm not as bad as these people.
Yes.
And makes it acceptable. This becomes the norm and something that we not only tolerate, but we actually come to the point to endorse.
Yes.
And believe that this is the way we live.
Well, you'll find Rogers and Maslow and the like on the bookshelves of churches.
Yeah.
And people think it's okay. Now, by their fruits you shall know them. 99% of the people who teach psychology are at least tacit atheists. And you send your kids to take courses from them? That's crazy. Send them to quantum physics. Most of them believe there's a God, at least. The harder the science, the more likely you are to come out of university with faith.
Huh.
We've got a lot of work to do here. But the key thing, of course, is having recognized this reality, what would happen if you started taking it seriously as a physician? I think what would happen is you'd go bankrupt. Because there's no billing category, is there?
No, but that's where you really affect people's lives.
Yes. So we really need to help them with how we're going to do this. And it seems to me that the saline solution approach just needs extending quite dramatically, particularly in the area of saying, okay, how do we connect these people to someone who will help them discuss their problem over the time course that's necessary? And what we need is some triggers that will allow them at least to move far enough to start discussing whether their guilt is real. Of course, it always is. But we've begun to look upon guilt as something that needs to be dealt with as a disease rather than as a symptom. I mean, Paul Brand would say, I think, that it's the pain of the soul, and it is the gift of pain to preserve our bodies from destruction. And guilt is the pain of the soul to preserve our souls from destruction. And instead of dealing with it, we're suppressing it. I look upon all these psychotropic drugs really as means not of dealing with the problem, but of making the patient incapable of complaining about it. It cannot be good news.
How do we approach patients that we know that's a component? Do we look at them and say, how are you feeling about your disease? I mean, how do you get into this with the patient?
Well, certainly it's got to be by questions.
Yeah.
One of the things we could do is, since we know that they're basically discontented with the medical system, one question that it might be worth trying at the end of the day, I mean, it'll take time, and you choose the right patients to do it. But you can say most patients are not happy with the medical system. Be honest with me. Are we serving you as well as we should? And if we're not, can you tell us why we're not? Because your treatment is better than it was ever before in the history of medicine. And that's when the existential questions will come up. And then I think we're free to say, you know, the question that's really bothering you is not a medical question at all. The problem is that people no longer believe in a pastoral or a priestly function in society, but the need is still there and they're asking doctors to fulfill it. Not explicitly, but implicitly. And we're not trained to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And neither in the structure of our world can we do so because of litigation and overheads and insurance and all the rest. So, you know, I talked to a doctor, say, what kind of day you had? As one of them said to me, technically a good day. I saw all my patients in 15 minutes. I filled in all the appropriate forms. It was an efficient day, but it wasn't that good. I did talk about Christ once.
Well, it's interesting when you go and you've been in Africa like I have. There, the first question people ask is, what is the meaning of this disease?
Yes.
Why did I get it?
Yes.
And what have I done wrong that caused me to have this disease?
They expect the spiritual dimension to be involved.
Right. And that question is still there in this country,
but
people are not verbalizing and doctors are not addressing it.
Yes. And, of course, in Africa, the pastor goes to see every patient. The hospital chaplain, so to speak, is not a concept they have. He's the pastor. And unfortunately, I take some flack for this, but I think it's true. In my experience, most of the hospital chaplains I've met have been people who couldn't run a congregation. And they did not have a deeply supernaturalist faith. And I'm not interested in a faith that isn't a thoroughgoing supernatural faith, because the problems we face are clearly not soluble at a purely human level. So there have got to be means whereby we move on. I've been in some of these in clinics for the indigent poor where they actually approach this dead on, straight on, because their lives are dysfunctional in an undeniable way. And they they have a meeting with the pastor and the doctor and the other people that are involved at the beginning and at the end, talking about taking charge of your life and allowing God into it. And those kinds of people are open to it. But in the States, you're much better off than most places. People are willing to pray. And maybe instead of us asking them, do you want to pray, we should start getting people, Christians, in there, say, why don't you go for prayer before you come to see the doctor so that you can pray for him that he does a good job with you? A lot of people, I think, would say yes to that.
Well, I'm seeing some movement with members. I was just writing a letter this morning to a group down in Asheville, North Carolina, where they're getting the churches to start working in the praxis with cancer patients, really yes. trying to serve them, but also to put meaning and context into what's happening yes. to them. And from another doctor who's really got a holistic practice where they're referring to nurse counselors and Christian counselors in their practice and incorporated that all together, I think some people are starting to get it yes. because that's where real satisfaction in practice comes from and real therapy and impact on patients, especially those with self-inflicted chronic diseases.
Yes. Well, the whole parish nurse movement, we probably ought to be giving more assistance to. Because I maintain that any church with more than 300 members should seriously think about hiring a nurse. Mm. And the function would be primarily to know who is sick and to go with them for any interaction with the healthcare system. Not to sit outside in the waiting room, but to be there for the interview with the doctor. Now, as you well know, and as all doctors know, most litigation is failed communication. And it's failed communication because of time pressures. Now, if a nurse is there, particularly with the elderly, whose processing time is getting longer, the doctor can communicate a lot of the technical stuff to the nurse very quickly and efficiently. Then she, in most cases, will go off with particularly the old people and say, let's go and have a coffee and talk our way through this.
Become the translator.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And churches can actually get those programs paid for because the old people so appreciate that support in the context of a very worrying interview with the medical system, that they'll change their wills in favor of the program to keep it going.
Yeah.
It's this spiritual dimension is now so big, and even the universities are putting spiritual into the biopsychosocial model, but spiritual is just code for anti-Christian at the moment. So we also have to work our way around that. Now, I have one friend in Canada who's brilliantly solved this problem. There's one bit of the medical school that we should go for, and that's the bits that people don't like doing. The communications course is always a problem, and the clinical skills course is always a problem. It's not done well because the usual failure of teaching, you must love the subject and love the student. This guy does, and he thought about how to do this. He realizes that the liberal elite wish us to think of ourselves as multicultural with a one-model-fits-all view of all these things, which simply isn't true. As I usually say, there is no such thing as a multicultural patient. You've never seen one and you never will. We always deal with particularities, including particularities of belief. Now, the medical fraternity is by no means a random cross-section of Americans. In particular, it has a very high proportion of immigrants because immigrant people are highly driven and talented people, so their kids get into medical school. They're not representative of America or Canada. So the first thing he does is he gets the class, the first year class, to identify their own belief systems. And then he puts up an overhead showing what that's like. They build it right there. And then he overlays it with the StatsCan data for the beliefs structure of Canada, which they collect every 10 years. And there are surveys in the US that you can find, not quite so good, but pretty good. Now, they don't fit at all. You know, there's virtually no Hindus and Buddhists. All those others are less than 1% of the population, but there's always a significant proportion of them in medicine, the highly motivated ones. So he says, it looks as though we're biased in relation to the population with our belief systems. How is that going to show up as bias in our handling of those patients? The students are idealistic and open at the beginning, and they recognize there's a problem. And then he talks a little bit about cleverly taking the top four or five. He says, let's do it in a modern outcome-based approach. We must deal with common things first, mustn't we? Now, what's the biggest group we deal with? Now, it's in Quebec. although they're actually postmodern, culturally they're still Catholic. When you die and when you suffer, you have to default to something to help you handle it. So he spends about half an hour on this stuff. The next hour and a half, he's got a Catholic priest and a Catholic doctor. He's got a liberal Protestant and a liberal Protestant priest, an evangelical Protestant and an evangelical doctor, a Jew, a Hindu, and a Muslim. He hasn't managed to find a Buddhist. And then the students rotate, and these pairs discuss a real patient with them. It is incredibly successful.
Hmm.
The patients love it. I mean, the students love it because it makes so much sense to them, and they're still open to being honest and helpful. And it opens their eyes in a big way.
Gets them talking about a topic they need to be thinking about.
Yeah, and we need to go for that little bit of the curriculum. There are bits of the curriculum that are wide open to us because we can do them and they can't.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this article you mentioned by Hunt.
Not Hunt, Hart.
Hart, thank you.
H-A-R-T. David Hart. I hadn't come across him until last year. He's a brilliant writer. He writes with passion and with elegance. So it's the kind of article that you might read the first paragraph and not continue because you say this is going to be too much to deal with. But if I could persuade a significant proportion of CMDA members, first of all, to read it and then learn the next art form, the skill that you need when you come across an important thing that you don't understand as thoroughly as you should, what they need to do is take a piece of paper and rewrite each paragraph in their own language. It's called making a précis. Not to put your ideas into it, but to distill his ideas into the simplest form that you can understand. But basically what he's arguing is very interesting. He says, fundamentally, we are a society that believes in nothing. Even in church, compared to our forefathers, we believe in nothing. We do not go into church with a fear of a God, do we? The fear of God is non-existent. As I usually say, even our architecture demonstrates this change. Medieval architecture was vertical, and when you went in, you raised your eyes and you lowered your voice. Modern church architecture is horizontal, and when you go in, you look sideways to your neighbor and you chatter. That's how trivial our world has become.
That's true, and even most churches now have a large foyer where that chitter-chatter can take place more,
yes,
in a coffee bar. And you
yes, know, that's
you
right.
Know.
A very different structure. So he says that doesn't mean we don't believe in anything, but we certainly don't believe in any overarching great thing that should dominate our lives. And he goes on to say, if you were to ask Americans, what is the overwhelming moral consensus for America that everybody agrees on, including to a very large degree Christians, it's the absolute liberty of personal choice.
Mm-hmm.
We are fundamentally a voluntarist society. Now, this is not Christianity. The fundamental thing about the whole story is that God says, if you do it your way, you fall apart. Freedom for the Christian and for the Jew is determined not as freedom from interference, which is what this kind of choice amounts to, but freedom for living within the framework which God has set. And there's no question as to which is the greater freedom. The other one, ultimately, is anarchy. It only hangs in because some of us have vestiges of the past with us. And as our saltiness diminishes, Jesus tells us what's going to happen. It's going to fall apart. And we can see it everywhere. We all know it. Even the people who would like to deny it deeply know it. Hence J. Budziszewski's Things You Can't Not Know. And yet we're rationalizing them all the while, rationalizing our desires, our choices. So he lays that out for you, and he points out there are some people who will say, I cannot have an abortion now because I feel that it is too far advanced in pregnancy. He says, that's precisely the point. It's not that they think it's wrong, it's that they feel that they should not do it. And this guy, he says, will not buy an SUV because he thinks of himself as an environmentally friendly guy. But it's his choice. We even present the gospel as a choice most of the time. And Jesus said, you did not choose me, I chose you. The old concept of prevenient grace is almost forgotten. And yet, we all claim to believe John 3, but there's Jesus saying to Nicodemus, unless you're born of the Spirit, you cannot see, you cannot comprehend the kingdom of heaven. That's gone. We see, we choose, and then God is there for our utility. That won't do. Now, what he then goes on to do is very clever. He talks about what actually happened in the first centuries and how different it was and why the liberal elite are right to be afraid of us, because we like to think how nice we are, but Christianity is actually corrosive to all other religions. The Muslims are right, the liberals are right, we are actually dangerous. We don't realize how dangerous we are. But if you look at history, anybody who thinks about it can see how dangerous it is. And within a very short time, without any political power, Christians took over, the temples were closed, the gods, small g, were dead. And he said, they cannot actually come back. I used to say we're heading towards neo-paganism. And in one sense that's true, but not the old gods. There are a few quirky people on the edge, but their religions are not even serious, are they? They're more appropriate to a boutique than a church. Silly games, really. Lewis in Till We Have Faces has the problem of the old woman who still wants to worship the old stone that's bloodied with the sacrifices, not the new Greek statue. Because there's something deeply there in the idea of sacrifice. All societies have had it, atonement. That evil is real, that a real entity has been offended, and that some form of atonement is necessary. That's hardwired in all of us. And so the old gods cannot come back for that because they've been discredited. They were destroyed. The temples were empty. The sacrifices finished. So now we're left just with the inviolable will. But if the will is all that exists, you're actually standing on the edge of an abyss of meaninglessness. Nietzsche knew that. He drove him mad. Well, his syphilis did too, but the philosophers have no answers. You know, people write to them and say, what are your answers to the big questions? They don't reply. And unfortunately, our faith has been sort of domesticated, hasn't it? We've domesticated God, made him fit our image rather than the other way round. And it's only when things get really bad and you're down on your knees and saying, Lord, I need help, that God, who's always there, becomes apparent to us again. So these things obviously fit together. The change in society, the change in the structure of religion. But this particular article is worth the struggle to read. And once you realize that this person's problem is that they have no real beliefs in anything that matters. And yet as a human being, they cannot flourish without a belief. Oh Lord, you made us for yourself. And as Augustine said, our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. We don't need a more seeker-friendly gospel. We need a more truth-friendly gospel that confronts the world with what its real problems are. And I find that the joy of my life at the moment is the number of students who actually want serious questions. And I have the best times in highly liberal environments. Because you can always get at them by saying, I'm glad to be in an environment where you have open minds and you will confront any idea. Now, it's wicked to do it to them, it's pure rhetoric, but that's what they say. Well, hold their nose to the grindstone. And so they say, okay, we'll take you on and we'll win, and they lose.
You just enjoy that too much,
I
John.
Love that too much. Yes, no doubt I will have to repent. But I was in Madison not so very long ago, and after an hour's lecture, the students went and got a change in the curriculum after the lecture. Hmm. Now, that's never happened in the more Christian schools. The Christians are intimidated. They don't think that they have the power even to change things. But if you have the argument and you can force an open discussion, you can win, and students have power. Now, in my own university, I have no power at all. Of course, I'm not there anymore now. I've retired, but I was marginalized because they wouldn't argue with me because they didn't win. Mm-hmm. But we ought to be doing this now. The more subtle people are beginning to do the right things, get into the dean's office, take over the curriculum, particularly take over the curriculum. Make sure that it's patient-centered and outcome-based. Those two words are pure gold for us. Because what would patient-centered ethics look like? Well, it'd be 9 lectures on Judeo-Christian ways of confronting death and suffering and injustice, and one for all the rest.
Yeah.
And none for agnostic atheists, because that's for the postdoctoral course.
John, as usual, you've stimulated our thinking and challenged our preconceptions, and I want to thank you again. And I'm just so glad that you're still running around the country speaking. You've been here in Grand Rounds this week and with doctors' groups and in churches, and just thanks for being part of this. And I think one of the exciting things that happened this week, and people interested in knows, that we put a lot of your best talks on DVDs, and they're going to be available, and you're going to be going a lot of places, not even having to travel there.
So but the only problem, I should warn people, that they made me do them short. So they're all about half an hour. So actually, they're an introduction to each of the talks. You need an hour in every case. So
Whet their appetite, get them going, and then you'll be traveling there.
So. Yes. Well, I hope they'll be coming to Ottawa to physicians' courses in the summer. Visit our website, augustinecollege.org, and you'll find stuff there that interests you, with stuff on same-sex marriage and things like that, written from a more philosophical point of view. But it's a pleasure to be here, and I hope to have an Augustine program here at the headquarters,
We're working on that. Stay tuned.
Yeah,
hey, great. Thanks, John. Wasn't it great to hear John Patrick? He always stimulates my thinking. And I encourage you to take the next step. Check out the website on Augustine College. Go spend some time with John this summer. Get a copy of What We Can't Not Know. You can go to our website and our Life and Health resources. It's available there. And that'll really let you dig deeper into this topic. And I really encourage you to get some copies of the DVDs, Just Add Water. We just put these together so you'd have the opportunity to reach out to your colleagues. We hear from so many members who say, yeah, I want to do something in my community, but where do we get a speaker? What do we talk about? Well, with this resource, you can invite folks over to your home or out to a church site or whatever, have a few refreshments, some fellowship, and then pop one of these into a DVD player, and you'll have a great meeting, good discussion. There's 3 or 4 questions that John asks at the end that you can begin talking about. And really grow in your faith. You'll get your batteries charged through this time of fellowship and learning together. I encourage you to do that today. These are very reasonably priced, just I think $7 for the cost of materials and shipping and handling is included. So you can't get a better deal than this. We encourage you to become the missionary to your medical or dental community where you live.